offering. Loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, we welcome you to this week's afternoon satsang. After a long while, we are back again with the Ramakatha Raswaini series. We will be continuing the beautiful story of Lord Rama as written by our dear Swami. But before that, as always, let us begin by meditating and ruminating over the nectarous name of Lord Rama.
Sri Rama Rama Rameti Rame Rame Manorame Sahasranama Tatulyam Ramanama Varanane Ramanama Varanane
Yes, dear listeners, we're going to start the Ramayana series. We left it a long time ago. We had a couple of weeks break in between, thanks to the Christmas celebrations and the New Year's Day. But now it is time to get back to the story as we were following it. But before that, let me welcome Brother Arvind to join me and join all of you in this afternoon satsang. Sai Ram, Arvind.
Sai Ram, Prem. And as always, let us begin by placing our humble salutations at the lotus feet of our dear Swami, who is always with us irrespective of the time and place. And also our salutations to the great devotee of the Lord, who Hanuman, who has exalted himself to the level of a god by his devotion to Swami. He is our role model, our ideal. That is the reason, in fact, that Swami built the magnificent 65 feet statue of Lord Hanuman towering over the Vidyagiri. Because, you know, it's almost as if that hill which has been named Vidyagiri, Vidyagiri translates into the hill of education. Giri is mountain or hill and Vidya is education. It is so symbolic. It is there for all to see that once you reach the pinnacle of Vidyagiri, you come to Hanuman, the humble servant of Lord Rama. They say Vidya Dadati Vinayam. That is, education confers humility, and that is there for all to see. And therefore, as always, we offer our salutations to Hanuman, who is present wherever the glory of Sri Rama is sung. And with that, we begin this week's episode.
Coming back to the story, we were at the part where Kaikeyi has placed her two boons in front of Dashrata, and Dashrata has, it has been conveyed to Lord Rama, not that Dashrata himself has spoken it out, because he is so pained that he is not even able to convey them to Lord Rama. But when Rama comes into the presence of the mother and Dashrata, Kaikeyi actually explains the whole situation. And even before he could get a verbal directive from his father, Lord Rama accepts the word which his father has given as his own word, and he says that I'll gladly take it upon myself. So the situation is that he has gone to Mother Kaushalya, he's explained it to her, and managed to convince her that she should stay back and take care of Dashrata. He has again had a dialogue with Lakshmana, and surprisingly a very short one, at the end of which he has accepted that Lakshmana can follow him to the forest. Mm-hmm. And now we are in the situation where Lord Rama is leaving the palace of Kaushalya, and he walks barefoot towards the palace of Sita, where he left her last when he was called to the palace of Dashrata. So the situation there is very interesting, because she is waiting for Rama to come back so that he can start the procession towards the coronation hall.
And she is expecting him to be dressed in all regalia. She is expecting a grand heralding, because he is no longer just Rama the prince. He is about to be coronated as Rama the crown prince and the emperor designate. And therefore, when she sees Rama walking in just like any commoner, he is not even wearing footwear, and he is not in any of the grand dresses. Forget grand dresses, he is looking almost like an ascetic in the clothes that he is wearing. And when he walks in, Sita is in a state of shock. And now, shock can do two things to a person. One is it can strike you dumb. The other is it can just unleash, open the floodgates within and unleash a torrent. And that is what, the latter is what happens in the case of Mother Sita. She rushes to Rama and says, Rama, what is this? Where is that where is the elephant that is supposed to trumpet and herald your arrival, you know? Just like we had all our processions here in Prashanthi Nilayam that would be led by the magnificent Sai Gita. She was expecting, Swami even gives a name, I forgot the name of the elephant, some Vijay, meaning victorious, something related to victory. That is the name of the elephant, that is the name of the tusker that Sita proclaims and says, he is supposed to be leading your entire procession. And then where are the trumpets? Where are the clarion calls? Where are the people throwing flowers? Where are the dancers? Where is the band? Where is the merriment? Where is the regalia? Where is that magnificent golden umbrella that should protect you? That should be above you? If not just to protect you as regalia, that is the royal insignia. All these are lacking. Rama, what happened? What calamity has befallen? What is it that has happened? And even as Sita pours out these questions in a torrent to Rama, Rama simply answers her. He says, Sita, you know, there has been a change of plans. It is, when we read Swami's writing, it shows how, you know, how clinically yet so simply in a matter-of-fact manner Rama explains that, you know, things have changed, Sita. It was supposed to be like that, but now Father has told me that I have to go to the forest. So he wants to ensure that it happens at the same, by this auspicious hour. And therefore, just like I got ready for the coronation, it's now time for me to get ready for going to the forest. And, you know, reading what Rama answers is just 3-4 sentences. But reading that, it speaks volumes about the equanimity that Rama possesses. Because just like there was no bubbling excitement and enthusiasm just before his coronation, there is no kind of depression or shock at this. This is really a rude change of circumstances. It's like you would have been on the zenith of a mountain, now you are at the nadir of a valley. But Rama is the same composed, calm person. And just as he said that I'm going to get coronated tomorrow, he says, I have to leave for the exile today or tomorrow. And that is how Rama answers Sita.
And very beautifully, you know, as you said, those three sentences, the way Swami writes it, absolutely no contempt, absolutely no anger. In fact, he doesn't even tell about the boon which is asked by Kaikeyi. He does not mention Kaikeyi at all. He just says that Father has given me an order and I have to follow, and that is what it is. And I think after that Sita starts asking, you know, what is the reason, what is the change of plans because of? And that is when Lord Rama starts explaining that, you know, Mother Kaikeyi had asked for two boons, and it is as a result of those two boons, one being the coronation of Bharata and the other being that I should be sent to the forest. And even then, you know, Mother Sita also, she doesn't stop and starts getting angry with the people who've caused this turn of events. She says there must be a reason for that. You know, both Dasharatha and Kaikeyi are such respectable individuals. There must be a good reason for them to come up with a command like this.
One thing that strikes me, Prem, is if we have to appreciate the glory of the characters of the Ramayana, the best thing would be to sincerely imagine ourselves and put ourselves in their position. When I did this exercise, for example, as I was reading this, when I put myself in Rama's place, and I was imagining, suppose I have to go and tell my wife now that, you know, it's no longer glory and kingdom, it's going to be gory and the forest. You know, it's a change from good news to horrible news. So when I was imagining, you know, the first sentence that came to me was, I go to my wife and say, you know what, this Kaikeyi is such a horrible lady. Till now, you know, tell me, have I any time disregarded her? Have I not considered her as my mother always? You know what she has done behind my back? You know, that was the first statement that came to me when I truly put myself in Rama's position. But the way Rama went, and now as you highlighted it, he doesn't even mention the name of Kaikeyi. And, you know, as I put myself in Sita's position, I was thinking that even if I manage to, you know, surmount my emotions and just say that, you know, nothing, you know, this is what has happened. And then when she asks for details, if I tell her that, you know, Mother Kaikeyi actually asked, I was thinking that any wife will naturally say that, you know, that woman is so scheming because, see, after all, Sita does not actually belong to this family. She's an outsider in the sense that she has come from Janaka's kingdom, and it is just very, she's a new bride even now, because within an year of marriage, within a year of the wedlock, Dasharatha has contemplated making Rama the crown prince. So she has not actually got enough time to have got to know everybody equally. And this is what often happens. This is the cause for so many husband-wife fights, where the husband finds fault with the wife's family and the wife finds fault with the husband's family. But we don't see that here. Sita could have easily, I mean, that was apparently the most spontaneous expression that will come, and it is understandable also. Nobody will criticize her for criticizing the people who have brought about the downfall of such a noble personality like Rama. But she too exemplifies what a noble woman is. And she just says that there definitely is a reason. It is not without reason that the elders have done like this. I only felt that what Sita feels towards elders, can we feel that at least towards God? We don't even spare God, you know. We feel God has done unfair things to us. He is putting us into soup, or He has put us into trouble, or He has failed to come to our rescue. If the amount of understanding that Sita had towards elders, you know, when she said that, I'm sure the elders will have a reason behind this, and it's nothing to feel bad or nothing to feel angry on them. I felt inspired that we should try to imbibe this at least with respect to God, if not with all our elders.
I think one more thing is, you know, the thing which shows up here is, what is your spontaneous judgment of a person? Mm. See, eventually you might find out that that person had, you know, these plans for ever since you knew them, or it was going on behind you. But what is the first spontaneous response when you know that something has befallen you? You know, giving the benefit of doubt to the other person, that I'm not sure what has happened, but maybe that person has a reason. You know, maybe that person has done it with a positive outlook. I think that is an important thing, as you're saying, that when you're not able to have that kind of an attitude even towards divinity, it's very difficult when you're talking about other human beings around. But I think that's a very important quality to have, you know, when you have the first response to a situation.
Hmm.
And Swami would often say that, you know, when a person comes and slaps you, okay, instead of getting angry, are you able to think that what could be the reason? You know, to stop and think that I will not be slapped without a reason. And maybe that person has a good reason to. I know it's very, very difficult. Being put in a situation is completely different from sitting behind a mic and talking.
I don't know why you're using this example, Prem, because this very example, I remember it's vividly imprinted in my mind. Silas sir from higher secondary school, when we were in a Parayanam session, he mentioned exactly this. He said, I will consider myself truly spiritual if somebody comes and slaps me, and I don't react, and I just think that this is what Swami wanted. Because if Swami did not want, I would not have got this. What is the meaning behind this? What is the purpose behind this? And I start, you know, questioning myself. You know, I start analyzing myself for this experience. That is when I'll consider myself spiritual. In fact, recently we uploaded part 7 of Raja Reddy sir's conversation with Anil Kumar sir.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful it is, you know. I think I was seeing the part 7 or part 6, I don't remember which part it is.
Mm-hmm.
Every part is beautiful, but in one of those parts, he says that. He says, the mistake we do in spirituality is, we analyze Swami and try to experience ourselves, because we are selfish. We should analyze ourselves and just experience Swami. Then we become selfless and we become spiritual. So, yeah. That the slap actually led my train of thoughts over here. So as you say, it's really tough when somebody hits you or slaps you for you to think that, you know, there's a purpose behind this, and give benefit of doubt to the offender whom we consider as offender. It's really a tough task.
Very true. I think in a sentence you can say, in every situation, if you can reflect rather than react, I think it would be a better option. But having said that, it's very difficult. I'm not telling. I think none of us are speaking that out of authority of practice.
Just out of theory.
I mean,
and
from reading this, it appears like that's the best thing to do.
Because exactly.
That was the reaction of Mother Sita. And, you know, again, you know, it's very important to put yourself in that place and imagine. Imagine you're standing there, as Swami describes, she's standing with that plate of sandal paste, which has to be applied to the forehead of Lord Rama before he, you know, walks towards the coronation hall. She's waiting with that golden plate with sandal paste. And that's when Rama comes like this, barefoot, walking without any accompaniments of regality.
Mm-hmm.
And then he says this, I'm going to the forest. You know, that situation, the way it has changed so fast is, can be so unsettling. You know, going back to, I think last week you spoke about that car analogy which Swami gave. You know, when things change so completely, I think it's a typical example of that. Though she is saying that elders must have a reason for it. What Swami told was, when there is a change in situation from what is conducive to you and something which is absolutely unacceptable to you.
The gear example, right? Yes, surrender.
Swami would say that, understand that nothing happens without it being without being a good reason for it to happen. But that's precisely what even Mother Sita is saying, that, you know, something like this has happened, there must be a good reason for it.
And, you know, though she does not react negatively towards Kaikeyi or anybody when Rama tells her the reason behind Dasharatha having commanded him like that, Rama continues to speak to her. You know, he says, it's almost, you know, it appears as if Rama does this in order to show the virtues and the character of Mother Sita to the world. That's all it is, because I don't think, forget Rama, you know, when we look at Sita's response itself, we feel admiration towards her equanimity. But Rama goes on to tell her that, you know, whatever it may be, don't harbor any of these in your mind. Serve your in-laws very sincerely. So don't bear any ill will towards them. Don't show any anger towards them. Be sweet. Be nice towards them. Please do not return to Mithila, to your parents' home, because that is the refuge, as per the Indian tradition. For the daughter, the refuge is always the mother's home. They call it Maika in Hindi, and, you know, it's like a refuge. Anything troublesome in life, you can return to your mother's home. That is always there for you. So, in India especially, that is of course changing now with modern trends, but in case of any marital woes or any trouble, the wife, the daughter usually returns to the mother's home. So here Rama is saying that, you know, I'll be gone for 14 years. Now imagine, your husband, you're just married and your husband is not going to be there for 14 years because of what your in-laws did. Not even your mother-in-law, your stepmother-in-law. So Rama tells her, please don't go back to Mithila. Stay in Ayodhya itself. Take care of everyone. So, when we read it, it doesn't look like Sita needs any of this advice.
Yeah, I think even Rama goes on to say that Bharata is going to be a new king. You have to treat him with the respect which you would have given me as a king. And, you know, all said and done, he might be a beautiful thing is, you know, in Indian tradition, there are some relationships which are so very beautiful, especially that between, you know, the wife has towards the younger brother of the husband. Immediately your relation is that of a mother and a son. So she says, though by relationship he is your brother-in-law and you can treat him like your son, but remember that he is going to be the monarch. So you have to give him all the respect and obedience that you would have given me as a monarch. And, you know, the interesting thing is, I think sometime back I had heard one psychologist speak about parenting. And this lady, this doctor, very an eminent expert, she was saying that there is a change in attitude in parenting. You know, now parents hesitate to advise their children because they feel advising is a sign of not having faith in their children. Like, you know, let's say your kid is going out on a party or something. Giving advice means you believe that you don't trust that person and so you're advising. But this expert was saying that that's not the case. As a duty, a parent should always keep telling to the children what is right and what is wrong. You know, even if you know absolutely surely that that person is not given to doing anything wrong like that, as a parent, it is, you know, it is your onerous duty to always keep advising. And she's saying that that is slowly vanishing from modern parents. And that is, in a sense, causing the problem in, you know, children not growing up in the right way. So I think, in a sense, that's what Lord Rama is doing. As you said, definitely Mother Sita would have known all these things which Rama was telling. But still, Rama said that it is my duty now to explain these things to you. It shouldn't be said that I, you know, I fell short of my duty, so I will explain it to you.
As we read on, it becomes amply clear that actually Mother Sita does not require all of this. In fact, Mother Sita begins to laugh. When she hears all this, she begins to laugh. And Rama is now surprised. What is the reason why Mother Sita is laughing when I'm saying all this? And Sita says, oh Lord, you are speaking as though it is a foregone conclusion that you will be going alone to the forest and I will be staying back here. Who said that I will be staying back here in the palace? I am not going to return to Mithila, definitely. Because once I am married to you, I am yours. And I am yours forever. And no forest, no command, no order can ever separate a husband and a wife. And therefore, though I am not going to return to Mithila, I am not going to be staying in the palace here. I am going to be accompanying you. And that now begins a new direction in the dialogue between Lord Rama and Mother Sita, because this is apparently something of a shocker for Rama. He is not expecting Sita to tell that, you know, I am going to come along with you. All the while he is preparing her for, he is thinking mentally and explaining to her how she should be when she is in the palace. And here is Sita now dropping a bombshell on Rama with a laughter. You know, Swami says with a rippling laugh, she says that, I am not going to be here, I am going to come with you.
And I think one of the first things she says in argument of that is, so the king has given you a command, and when he gives you a command, it automatically applies to me, because I am, as Swami would say, and as it is said in the scriptures, Ardangi, you know, I am the better half of you. So when a command is given to you, it need not be mentioned that take Sita along. It is like understood that I'm going to come along with you. So you have to accept me. And it's interesting, even as I was going through this particular argument of Mother Sita, you know, it takes me back to what happens with Ratnakara, right? Before he becomes Valmiki. Because that is one of the first things which he is told. Go and ask your wife if she will be a party to your karma, the bad karma that you're taking. But I think what shows is you cannot, your karma is not shared between a husband and a wife, but I think the choice is always there to take upon yourself what is good and bad of the husband. I think, and that's what Mother Sita is pointing out here, that I was happily, you know, till now, I was happily celebrating the moment of me becoming a queen. Because if you are going to become the monarch, I'm going to become the queen. So when now the situation has changed, in what way am I going to remain back here as a princess, as a daughter-in-law? I mean, a daughter-in-law is always a special person in the kingdom. But I'm not going to remain here as a special person when you are going forth as a, you know, mendicant into the forest.
And when Sita says this, Rama begins a line of argument, if you can say. And seeing the different arguments that Rama places, again it becomes clear, you know, the way it has been written, it becomes very clear that Rama is convinced that what Sita has hit the nail on the head in the right, in the first blow itself. Because, you know, he doesn't say that, no, you should, his, the order in which he argues itself shows his priorities. Because when in an argument, when in a debate or any time, we often place the most important arguments first and later on bring in the lesser important ones. The idea being, if there's no time for the lesser important ones, no problem. These most important ones have to be the ones that are resolved. And the first thing that Rama says is not about the kingdom or not about anything. The first thing Rama says is that Sita, see, it's not an easy decision because the forests are infested. They're infested with wild animals, with rakshasas, with demons, and there are a lot of hardships. So, you see, when this is the first argument that Rama is placing, it becomes very clear that the reason Rama is trying to tell Sita to stay back in the kingdom is not because when he's gone, she should serve his parents or she should be there as support to his brother Bharata or anything. It is just because Rama is concerned for his wife, because just as Sita feels that Rama is my other half, Rama feels Sita is my other half, and let at least one half of me be comfortable. So let her be comfortable. Why should she suffer for what has been given to only one half of me? That is me. Let me go. She will not be able to bear it. So she says, Sita, it is very difficult there, so don't come. That is the first argument he poses to Sita. And Sita, you know, no less in her response, she says, Rama, what are your worries? You know, what are your worries? She is trying to play the other side. Now she says, are you worried that I have got so used to the luxuries in the palace that I will not be able to cope with the rigorous life in the forest? She immediately takes a vow to lead a very simple life. And she says that dangers, if you are worried about hardships, don't worry, I have taken a vow to lead a simple life. So a simple life involves hardships which I will gleefully accept. And if you say of dangers, what danger can touch me when you, my husband, my lord, the supreme protector of the whole kingdom of Ayodhya is with me? It is almost as if Sita is saying that possibly Ayodhya is in danger because you are not there. But when I am with you, nothing can ever happen to me.
Right. And you know, even as I was reading this, I was reminded of an experience of one of our old students.
Hmm.
This person, his father had a shop in Puttaparthi, a small shop which used to sell books and photographs and all that. So even as this boy was a student, he had made up his mind that, you know, after he finishes his studies, he would just settle down in Puttaparthi and take care of that shop, because there was one source of income already there, and just spend time with Swami. So he finished his studies, and one night he had a dream in which Swami comes and tells him that, Swami tells him that it's better that you don't stay in Puttaparthi. So, you know, he gets very worried. He says, "Swami, why do you say that? Because my father's shop is here, my parents are settled here, so I'll just stay on here. What is the problem?" Swami said, "You'll have a lot of problems if you stay back here. You know, you're going to face a lot of financial problems, you'll have other problems which will be coming to you, and it's going to be unbearable, it'll be very bad." And the response which this boy gave in his dream was so beautiful, you know.
Okay, this is a dream.
This whole thing was happening in the dream. So in the dream, this boy is saying, "Swami, you tell me that you don't want me to stay here, I'll leave. Okay, you tell me that you have some other plans for me, I will leave. But don't tell me to leave just because there are going to be problems. Don't give me that as a reason. Because, you know, I'm ready to endure anything as long as I can be with you." You know, pretty similarly, that's what Sita is saying here. Don't give me the reason that there's not going to be any comfort there, there are going to be dangers there. Don't give me any of those reasons. And she's saying that, you are there to protect me. And are you having doubts about your ability to protect me? That's what she says.
Then, now, you know, Rama takes on another line of argumentation. He says that, "See, Sita, if you say that you want, I mean, just like he said, if you say that I want you to stay and you will stay, then fine, that is what I want. As your husband, I'm commanding you. It is the duty of the wife to obey her husband, and therefore, I'm commanding you to stay back." And to this, she says, "But see, you cannot command me because we are equal halves. We refer to each other as the other half. Just as you have the right and authority over me, I too have the same right and authority over you." And then comes, you know, the master stroke, you know, the sentence that really won my heart as I was reading this, because Sita says, "So I have equal authority and rights over you, my lord, but when I say I'm going to accompany you, I am not asking you as a matter of my right. I crave to be with you, Rama, and that is why I want to follow you, not because it's my right to be with you. I crave to be with you," and this shows that though Mother Sita is Rama's wife, she has so much of devotion. It is symbolic of the feelings that exist between Prakriti and Paramatma. I feel that is the same that existed or exists between that alumnus who you spoke about and Swami. That relationship is shown so beautifully here, because after all that, Sita is a devotee of her Lord. And she says, "I have a right, but I'm not exercising the right. I'm saying I want to be with you because I crave to be with you." That is such a beautiful thing, she says, and Rama seems stumped momentarily.
And the beauty is, you know, most of the arguments placed by Mother Sita is that. It is all stemming from that desire to be with you. And if you see all the explanations which Lord Rama is giving, it is all so that she doesn't have to undergo pains. You know, I think what Lord Rama is saying throughout this argument is, there is nothing which binds you to follow me to the forest. You know, there is nothing mandatory about that you should follow the forest. And if you don't do that, people will say that, you know, you are failing from your duties.
It reminds me, Prem, this is, I'm sure, what many of the alumni who are working here in Prashanthi Nilayam would have faced. I too remember facing this. You know, when we expressed, it was 2-3 of us together, myself, Dhananjay, we expressed to Swami that, "Swami, we want to be here, work for you and stay here." So, on the face of it, Swami immediately agreed. But before that, what had happened was, before actually Swami physically agreeing and accepting, there were a lot of things that happened. And one thing I got reminded of now here was, the secretary of the ashram then, that is Chakravarti sir, he called us. And just like this, you know, he spoke, he was saying, it's very evident that these are not his thoughts and his ideas, these are what Swami is wanting to be conveyed. So he had called, and just like we see here, Rama saying out of concern for Sita, not because he doesn't want. Rama as we all know, Rama in the end accepted Sita. It's not as if Rama does not want Sita to come along with him. In fact, towards the end we will see that Rama himself will say that, Sita, it is a great joy that you are there with me. It will be a wonderful, you know, it's a wonderful thing to have you accompany me. But in the beginning, he's always concerned about Sita, and that is the trait of the Lord. Because here Chakravarti sir was asking us, he was telling us, you know, he started by saying, see, it is not wrong to have ambition. Swami never discourages ambition. Swami never says that you should not pursue success and achievement. If you go out, achieve a good name, get good fame, Swami will be immensely happy. And if that is what you are desiring, there's absolutely no qualms. Please don't think that you are going against Swami by pursuing a career or pursuing success in a way that you think is best. Only thing is, yeah, while doing that also just follow what Swami has taught. This is the first thing that he said. So, you know, I could feel Swami's love through Chakravarti sir, because it was as if Swami saying that, see Bangaru, if that is what you're desiring, don't think that you will be distant to me if you pursue that, you can go. So that was one, this thing. Then second thing Chakravarti sir says is, he says, see, when you start working here, possibly you may not have Saturdays, you may not have Sundays. You may not have anything called a holiday. You may not have a summer vacation and winter vacation the way you're used to. You don't know when the hours of work will be. You don't know when you will be called on duty. There are many, many hardships here. And you know, even he went on to the aspect of the kind of enumeration. This being a NGO and being a non-governmental, being a charitable service charitable trust, they will not pay you the kind of remuneration you'll get in professional organizations, in multinational corporations, commercial organizations. Not professional, I mean. It's professional here also. In commercial organizations. So, this was also said, you know, so, as I was reading this, it felt so beautiful because of this experience, of joining Radio Sai, you know, I could feel the amount of love Swami has, the amount of love Rama has. So, it was so beautiful, and that is what is very, very clear when we read also, that when Rama is telling this to Sita, it is not out of anything else, it is just his love for Sita, and the whole dialogue becomes beautiful because we are getting to experience both at the same time, the Lord's love for the devotee and the devotee's love for the Lord, through dialogues of Rama to Sita and of Sita towards Rama.
And another thing which often happens, you know, because everybody faces this, this is not only about students, those earlier years when people used to come to Swami, you know, the kind of treatment they used to face by the locals around who were not favorable to Swami, or some people who used to come and their relatives used to talk, you know, how can you go behind a Baba and all that. You know, in many ways, these are all things which actually deepen your love and devotion. And there is this very interesting episode which comes in Shiva Puranam, you know, when Goddess Parvati wins the chance of being wedded to Lord Shiva. You know, she actually goes to the, goes into the mountains and she starts doing a penance with a desire to, you know, earn the hand of Lord Shiva. So it's, the story goes that she's been doing a penance for many years. Then one of the ascetics comes along, you know, a man with a long beard and withered with age. He comes and he looks at this, you know, beautiful princess there sitting. And I mean, she's supposed to be the princess of the realm of, you know, she's the daughter of Himavan, right? So he looks at her and says that, you know, you're a princess. You look so beautiful. You're one of the most beautiful people I've ever seen. I mean, it's so absurd that you want to marry a person, somebody like Lord Shiva. And he starts describing him in, you know, without any tasteful, devotional tastefulness, which, you know, a person who is in love with the Lord will do. He says he, you know, spends most of the time in the graveyard. He takes the ashes from the burnt bodies and applies it on himself.
He's semi-clad.
Right, and he, you know, wears the clothes, I mean, a skin of an elephant, and, you know, he adorns himself.
Tiger skin, right. Vyagram Bharadara.
Right. And he adorns himself with you know, the snakes, kind of describes everything about Lord Shiva and says, you know, you're such a beautiful young princess. Why do you want to marry that man? And she's very quiet because it's an elderly person. She doesn't want to offend him. But when at a point it becomes too much for her to bear, Parvati gets extremely angry and she says that, please leave my presence. I don't want to even talk to you. I know what I'm after. I know what my Lord is. And I'm ready to go to any extent to win his heart. And when she says this and she's, you know, she's just blown herself out in temper, that's when she finds that that old man transforms into Lord Shiva and says, I accept you.
Wow.
So in a sense, you know, I think it will happen in almost every devotee's life. When you want to go closer to Swami, I think Swami himself will put certain obstacles, because that's when you become stronger, that's when the yearning becomes more deeper and more genuine.
And it is only when that love and yearning is genuine that we will be able to see only beauty. Everything about Swami we will see as Satyam, Shivam and Sundaram. We will not feel that, you know, Swami is very nice, very good, only this one thing, this is really painful or this is bad, or we will not find anything about Swami painful. We will not find anything about this, about Swami which is not beautiful. And possibly it is with that emotion that that Madhurashtakam has been composed, where it describes everything about Krishna as sweet. In fact, you know, even as you were describing how that old man tells Parvati about how he wears a tiger skin and he is having ash all over his face in a not so good manner, I was just thinking the magic of devotion is such, for example, that bhajan, Shiva Shiva Shambho Hara Hara Shambhos, in that the second line is Vyagram Bharadhara Vibhuti Sundara Sai Shambho Shankara. The same terms which are used to, you know, actually portray what is supposed to be ugly about the Lord, the same terms with devotion become terms to sing. It becomes part of a bhajan. Ganga Jatadara Shankara, Chandra Kaladara Shankara, you know, Tandava Priyakara Natana Manohara. It is, you see, I'm getting goosebumps even as I say that. Devotion is what the Lord looks for, because once you have devotion, it doesn't matter whether you have beautiful long hair or matted locks, because everything about the Lord becomes Satyam, Shivam and Sundaram. And that is where we were high.
Going through these arguments which are happening, and Lord Rama describing very, very graphically what are the scenes which one would encounter in the forest and all that. And as you said, you know, Chakravarti is coming and telling you, this would happen very, very often, you know, with the boys who would say, after their studies, they would say that Swami would like to serve you. Mm. I'm reminded of one occasion, I think Swami had called some of those boys for an interview. That Swami was telling, Swami was randomly asking those boys, so what have you done? Said Swami, an MSc, an MBA, and some of them were double postgraduates and all that. And Swami was telling them, see, you've all studied so much. You know, we all know that we studied so that we could spend those few extra years with Swami. But Swami would, you know, put that itself as an obstacle in front of you. See, you've all, you know, obtained such high degrees. How can I just send you to the bookstall and make you arrange books there? Literally, that's what was the job available then, you know, 10, 15 years ago. I mean, now you have more important works coming up and, you know,
there are options.
Right, options are more, because that time there was hardly any things which boys could handle, except for a few accounts jobs and, you know, the book trust had to be taken care of. So I'm just saying that you're all MSc's and MBAs. How can I ask you to go and arrange books in the shelf?
You're all overqualified.
Right, you're extremely overqualified for that. You know, how can I do that? So these boys would say, Swami, even if you say you go and sweep, we'll do it. And Swami said, no. And Swami will get angry. He said, do you think Swami is so cruel that I'll make you do such work? He said, no, Swami, you are not cruel, but we are ready to even do that. Hmm. But this was the thing which would always happen. You know, Swami would describe all these things. Like as you said, Swami said, you know, the money is very less. You won't be able to send money home. That is one thing Swami would say. You know, what I give you is very less. It is enough to take care of yourself. You might not be able to send money to your parents and things like that. And Swami would say, you know, you don't have an accommodation to stay here. And all kinds of descriptions. But I think that was always the thing. And very beautifully that analogy which would often Swami himself would say of how the river, when it wants to merge in the ocean, right? That's a beautiful analogy, especially in this context, isn't it?
Exactly. The river, Swami says, comes to the ocean and tries to merge. The ocean pushes it back. The river fights. The ocean pushes. It goes on for long. Finally, when the river, when the ocean knows, you know, the river is not going to turn back at all because it is bound to merge into me. The ocean goes above like a wave and accepts the river to go within. And once that happens, in that moment, you don't know which is the ocean, which is the river, because there's only one. And that is the struggle, that final struggle that happens before, you know, the Lord wholeheartedly embraces the devotee and the devotee embraces the Lord. As you were describing, you know, Swami giving all these, on one hand, we brought it out as to show how Swami is compassionate and he is loving and he is thinking about our, what we might go through. The other thought that struck me right now is, you know, There are different levels of commitment. That is why, you know, people often say, can you give that to me in writing? Because apparently when you write it, it's committed. You can't go back on that. So I feel one level of commitment is at the level of the thought. But when we speak it, it's a higher level of commitment. And when you write it, it is the highest level of commitment. And that's why before any job, we are made to sign on a contract or sign on some kind of a documentation which shows our commitment to it. So I just felt that this was also another way of Swami bringing out to our own knowledge what is within us. Many times when I think of taking a job, you know, it's a, when I think of working for Swami, staying with Swami, on other hand, I also know the difficulties. It's not as if I need Swami to educate me on that or somebody, some emissary like Chakravarti sir to come and tell me about that. I myself have done the analysis and possibly all this analysis in my head is in my head. By bringing out in speech, one level commitment comes higher. I mean, I will not tell Swami that, Swami, actually, you know what? I think it requires guts to actually not feel that I am ready to sweep for Swami, but to tell Swami that, Swami, if you tell me to sweep, I will sweep. I may think that, maybe, you know, even if Swami makes me sweeper, it's fine. But unless I have one level of commitment, when Swami says that, you know, how I can't give you this, I will not have the courage to say. So, by doing this, Swami shows each one of us our own, you know, level of commitment, our own level where we stand. Because as test is definitely his taste, but he doesn't test to evaluate what we are because he knows what we are. The test is so that we realize what we are, and it is like a self, this thing, you know, the teachers or the university has nothing to do with what marks you get. They'll award degrees, it's a thing. But by the test, we get to know how competent or good we are. So that is the reason I feel, you know, another way in which Swami would tell all these so that we can verbalize and speak out so that it represents a higher level of commitment towards what we are actually feeling.
Very true. In fact, just like what happens here, remember once Swami had called some of these boys for an interview. Swami had called them for three interviews on three consecutive days.
Wow.
Okay, in the first interview, as soon as these boys entered, the first thing Swami said was, there are no jobs here. No, even before the conversation could start, Swami said, there's no jobs here, you all should go and look for good jobs and take care of your parents and be happy. So that's how the first day's first conversation starts. Okay, and all through the rest of the interview, Swami is explaining that there are no jobs. But in between, Swami say, okay, what have you done? What would you like to do? But still Swami is saying that, but you know, it's better you all go. Finally, it came to that last interview, I think the last half an hour of the third interview, or 15 minutes of the third interview, Swami started telling, what is there outside? And Swami was, you know, complete reversal of what he did on the first day. Swami said, what is there in the outside world? And Swami showed his empty hand and said, everything is there here. And he said, see, outside they'll give you 20,000 rupees. But by the end of the month, you know, you won't know where the money has gone. But here, if Swami gives you 1,000 rupees, you can have satisfaction in your heart. You can live your life to the full because you're doing whatever you're doing for Swami. So, you know, completely, I think in between, if somebody had changed their mind and, you know, desire to leave, they might have missed the last part, the concluding part of the thing. Because that's when Swami was, you know...
Oh, you mean in these 1 or 2 days itself after the interview, there were some who might have left?
Not necessarily, and not many left, but I'm saying the way...
If they had left.
Right, if they had left.
Okay.
Because the way Swami was describing the last day, it was completely different. Swami was giving counter-examples of boys who, you know, went outside and they were not very satisfied. They came back after 10, 15 years of working outside. They said, Swami, we would like to do something here. And I think we have a few students who came back like that. So Swami is saying, see, there's nothing outside. So if you have this desire to stay with Swami, foster it. You know, Swami was kind of encouraging that and saying that for some reason, out of some merit of your past birth, you've got this desire, hold on to it and foster it and, you know, cherish it.
In this context, it might be again a small digression, but a very, very poignant thought to mull upon. When you said that, Swami said the 1,000 rupees that Swami gives will give you great satisfaction. It reminds me of a kind of debate or a kind of discussion I had with a friend who was saying, you know, the way Central Trust accepts donations, the way Swami has made it, it's absolutely transparent and, you know, it's only like white money can come in because everything is accounted for. Only accounted money can come in. There is no scope for black money to come in. And the discussion was, why make it like that? The reason for supporting black money to come in was like this. That see, black money, what is black money? Black money is unaccounted money. Basically, it is money that society has been cheated of. Nobody in society knows of its existence. What better way to use black money rather than get it? What better way to use black money than getting it back into serving the
society? Right.
No, the central trust is doing only that. Nothing else. Not a pie goes elsewhere other than doing service for society. So why not allow black money to come in?
Mm-hmm.
That is the best use, right? And for a while even, I also felt the same. Yes, Swami, what is the rationale behind? And that is when I heard the experience, I don't know if it has been aired on Radio Sai, but I heard the experience of Professor Sudhir Bhaskar, who had this opportunity to walk behind Swami. And he said that on one occasion when he was walking behind Swami, I might be missing small details here, but the general story is this. A person handed over a cover to Swami and he apparently signaled to Sir saying that be careful with that envelope because it contains a check for a hefty amount or something like that, maybe a few lakhs of rupees. And Sir says that as Swami walked a few steps, he suddenly stopped, turned back, pulled out exactly that envelope from Sir's hand and gave it to Sir and said, you return this back. So he was surprised, but he said that it was very easy to locate the devotee because he had told me specifically. Imagine, even as Swami accepts the letter, turns and walks, he's telling Sir that, you know, that contains, be careful with that letter. So he immediately locates the devotee and gave it to him. The darshan round got over, and when they went into the interview room, from the bundle of letters, Swami picks out one and gives it, not in the interview room. In the darshan round itself, again Swami picks out another letter and tells Sir to keep it in his pocket. Now they enter the interview room, and once they're inside, Swami closes the door and tells Sir to take out that letter from his pocket.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, open it. So he's a bit hesitant because this is a letter addressed to Swami. Swami says, no, you open it. He opens and sees what is there inside. He pulls out, and again I don't remember whether it is 10 or 15, but something like 10 rupees or 15 rupees or 20 rupees, a counter foil. Usually when you make a donation, you get a counter foil. When you make a deposit, you get a counter foil. So some person has deposited 15 or 20 rupees into the trust, and the counter foil he has given it to Swami, you know, as that's like a proof. If the bank doesn't give, you can produce this counter foil and claim that 20 rupees. And Swami said, that man got overwhelmed by Swami's love. He has sacrificed his food for a day, and that money he has given to Swami. And Swami said, you know, if you think that the salary that Swami gives is less, just remember, it is this kind of money that I'm giving you as salary, not any other kind of money. Which meant, you know, there is so much importance that Swami gives to the vibrations associated with that money. And it was almost as if 20 rupees, you know, I'm not saying that this is the takeaway directly, but it appears as if the 20 rupees given with sacrifice and love is more important than the lakhs that might have been just thrown and don't know what kind of what it is. So, it answered my black money question because it is not just about money, it is the feeling behind the act that matters. And then I came across a story where Buddha refuses wealth and he accepts with glee an old copper coin offered by a woman, that is there, a chinakatha. So the vibrations that the wealth carries is also so important, and that is why, you know, now I feel I'm ready to answer if somebody asks why not have this as a channel, because don't know the vibrations associated with black money. So that is why it is, I mean, it's not as if all the white money also has pure vibrations. There might be selfish reasons. But definitely white money vibrations are...
No, talking about white money, and I'm reminded of some of the students who had accompanied Swami to one of the Kodai sessions. They were saying that during one of the sessions when they were sitting with Swami, you know, those days Swami would just pull out a letter and give it to somebody, and a couple of letters Swami would say, if it's a sealed envelope, no, what is there inside? So one of those letters Swami had given it to one of the senior teachers around, and he opened it and there was a check in it, a check for a hefty amount. So Swami asked for the check, and as he was talking to all these boys, very casually Swami just tore it into tatters and put it back into the envelope, and Swami gave it back to that person. And all these boys were shocked because they could see the figure on that check. It was quite an amount. And as Swami was doing this, and when he saw the surprise on some of the students' faces, Swami said, bad money, and put it back. And Swami very beautifully, you know, looked at them and said, I don't want your money, sir, I want your heart. And when Swami said this, Swami did not say, I will not take money and I'll take only hearts. He said, I am seeing the heart which is offering the money. it is not anything else. I'm not seeing the money when I take money from anybody. I'm seeing the heart. And it's really true. You know, that is why whatever Swami gave, whatever Swami did, you know, we might say that Swami is just treating patients in the hospital. You know, there's a hospital which is doing this. But even that money which is coming to treat those patients, I'm sure as we say something when we talk about vibrations, when you talk about energy, it's something which is completely intangible. It's so subtle that we cannot qualify it or quantify it scientifically. But I'm sure Swami must have, you know, thought about all these very, very, you know, gave so much importance to it. I'm not saying that Swami thought about all this. Swami gave so much importance to these things. So that is why I think it's a message for all of us. If we think that by giving money to the trust, we can contribute to Swami's mission, no, it is not so. I think it is only by contributing purity to the trust we can
actually do it. And that purity, yes. If you are channeling that purity through money, it's okay. If you are channeling that purity through seva, it's okay. But what is important is not the channel,
right,
but the purity and love. And, you know, that is what triggered when you said that Swami said the thousand. That is why the 1,000 rupees that Swami gives will give us the peace of mind, the serenity, right, and the love, which possibly the lakhs outside world gives will not be able to give us.
And very true. I mean, even in this argument which is happening between Lord Rama and Sita, I think that's the very thing, because the argument with Rama is placing is, he's completely trying to convince Sita that you are not bound to follow me. You know, don't follow me because thinking that if I don't do this, people might talk ill of me. So, you know, he's saying that very clearly. I am absolving you of that duty. I mean, for me, your duty is to stay back and serve my parents. And, you know, I don't want to put you through trouble. So, I am telling you that you don't have to follow. Ensuring that this decision to follow Rama is completely out of her own will. And she's doing it happily. You know, she's really doing it as a result of her craving. You know, that is what I think Swami is bringing out in this conversation. So that it is clear to everybody that Sita was not forced to follow Rama. It was not the, you know, societal bondages that made her follow Rama. It was not that, you know, her mother or father would have thought ill of her if she had not done this, and they would have seen her as somebody who had fallen off her duty. It was not anything like that. Swami is clearly saying that Sita was saying that this is where my happiness lies.
And I'm doing it of my own volition.
Yes, and because one of the arguments that Mother Sita says is, don't think that I'm happy because I'm in the palace. Don't think I'm happy because I'm sleeping on a comfortable couch. It's not the case. I'm happy here because I'm with you.
Exactly, because once Rama says, you know, he says, see Sita, when I leave and go, it's bound to be a very sorrowful thing for everyone. My father will be sad, my mother will be sad, my mothers will be sad, my brothers will be sad. When everyone is sad like that, on that when you add the sorrow of you leaving, it is going to be like a double whammy. So it is better that you stay back and console them, you know. This is the final argument Rama tries, not the final argument, this is one of the arguments that Rama tries. And when he tries that, you know, this is exactly what Sita says. Sita says, oh Rama, this association with whole Ayodhya, with the whole palace, with the king, with everything has come to me because of you. And it is not seeking them that I sought you. It is that I have got them because I sought you. That's it. I want only you. And so Rama, so when you yourself are forsaking all of them and leaving, then what do you say about me? You know, I have no relationship only with them then. Everything goes off because you are forsaking them. So when you have taken a decision that you forsaking them and the sorrow that is caused to them at that time is in accordance with dharma and whatever, then I don't think that this is a side thing to think about, you know. So she even says that my allegiance, my love is only to you, Rama. That is what Prakriti does to Paramatma, and that is what inspires. If we also say that, Swami, you know, our allegiance, you know, to if it comes to that, yes, it is not to Radio Sai, Swami. I am working for Radio Sai and I love Radio Sai because, Swami, it has Sai in it. But, Swami, my allegiance is always to you. Whatever you say, I will do. In the same way, my allegiance to my family, Swami, is because you have given me the family. And therefore, Swami, that is why, since you have given me the family, therefore they are important. But my first love is you, Swami. And if we can keep this remembering this always, Swami, you are my first love, you are my first love. You know, it might be a personal thing, but I would definitely love to share this. Before I got married, the first thing my going to be wife then and my wife now, Pooja, told me was, Arvind, if you don't mind, let me share with you that after marriage, you will not be my first priority. So I was a little shaken. I said, okay. And then she said, because that first priority has already been given to Swami. And when she said that, Prem, I had almost a tear in my eye. My eyes became wet. You know, I said the same from my side also. And I felt such a joy because there is an absolute phenomenal joy in keeping Swami as first priority. And that joy has to be experienced. And I felt very grateful to Swami that, for one, you know, that He has blessed me. He has, for whatever reason it might be, has blessed me with that priority that Swami is first. And He is also blessing me with a wife who shares a similar top priority. So I feel that the secret for serenity and peace in life to always have Swami as our first priority, because if we don't give first priority to Swami, it's like we are giving Him no priority. That's all it is.
And it's interesting, the way Swami would play up things where, this is very important, what you do for Swami and Swami Himself. Sometimes this clash actually comes in our functioning. I think we've seen it many times in the organization too. It seems, I don't know exactly, how the whole thing happened. Swami was once mentioning that there was a gathering which was happening in the Purnachandra Auditorium. I think something which was arranged for the organization people or something like that. And Swami was not actually going for it. And when asked, Swami said, they have their own schedule and they want to follow it. When you set up something in the name of Swami, and you would say that it has to be very punctual and it has to be very professional because it has got the because it's got Swami's name. But you want to become so professional that you want to exclude Swami's uncertainties out of it. That becomes very dangerous because, when I think I've sensed this many times even in our own working. Sometimes we do it for Swami, but we do it so much for Swami that for Swami becomes a top priority than Swami Himself. And this is very difficult to convey in words. But I think everybody will face this situation. For instance, many of the people who are in a family might think that, I'm taking care of my children for Swami. I'm taking care of my family for Swami. But when a situation comes when Swami Himself is coming, maybe that for Swami will, knock off the top priority than Swami Himself. And these are all things which, which are beautifully brought out in epics like this Ramayana, because all the arguments, the detail to which Lord Rama is going, to a point you might think that Rama is being a little cruel in subjecting Sita to this, because he is trying to say that the decision to follow Rama is completely wrong. That's the idea you would get from all the angles which Rama is explaining. In fact, he's saying that I'm the one who's giving you this command, will you disobey me?
In fact, this is a classic case of what you said, where, Rama is giving all the for Rama arguments. Sita, stay back in Ayodhya for Rama. Take care of his parents for Rama. Everything is like looking like the for Swami arguments, as you said. But it is credit to Mother Sita that she did not forget Rama in her pursuit of for Rama. For Rama is always secondary to Rama. And that is how she actually eventually succeeds in following Rama to the forest. And that part, dear listeners, we will come to after this little break. While speaking about the Lord's glories, both Prem and me have this weakness. We forget the time, we forget everything and just go on and on. So it is good that we have a clock that reminds us that it's time for a little break. But don't go away. We will come back and we will be there to bid a fond farewell to the trio of Rama, Lakshmana and Sita as they leave to the forest. But that is nothing to be sad about, because being enjoying the Rama Katha, we will also be there in the forest to receive them.
Shri Raghunandana Sita Rama. Sita Rama, Sita Rama, Rajiv Lochana Raja Rama, Rajiv Lochana Raja Rama, Rajiv Lochana Raja Rama. Rama, 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 ಭವ ಭಯ ಭಂಜನ ತಾರಕ ನಾಮ
Welcome back, dear listeners. We are in that interesting part where a beautiful conversation is happening between Lord Rama and Mother Sita, where Mother Sita is trying to win her way to join Lord Rama into exile. One more interesting argument which happens, in very beautiful, and I think it needs a little more keen looking at also. At one point, Mother Sita says that what about Kaushalya? You know, because all the argument which you have given should apply even to Kaushalya. So what is the argument you have given to Kaushalya? That's what Sita asks Rama. And in a sense, she says that I'm sure that you must have told her that she should stay back and take care of her husband.
Yeah, is because the way Kaushalya is attached to Rama, it is sure that she would definitely want to follow Rama. But now that only Rama has come, surely Kaushalya is not following. So what have you told her to stay back? You would have told stay back and serve your husband, right?
You told her, spoken about Patni Dharma.
Then now why should I not follow now here the omniscience and omnipresence of Sita is being revealed to Rama. And in a sense that is also correct. Prakriti, nature is also omniscient and omnipresent. And that is why nature has her own slow but sure way of rewarding and punishing. It is nothing but nature's omniscience and omnipresence. And here Sita is showing that. And she says, so what is it that you have told Kausalya? Have you not told her to stay back and do her Patni Dharma? Then why are you holding two different standards for women? If Patni Dharma is supreme, as it is in the case of Kausalya, then allow me also to do my Patni Dharma. And at this point Rama has to just accept defeat. He has to wave the white flag of surrender. But the interesting thing is, throughout this argument...
There is another argument before that. Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing about this is, on the face of it, it appears that Lord Rama is double-tongued. He's saying something to the mother and something else to his wife. But I think this also is a very interesting indicator of what actually is dharma, what actually is the right thing to do. I feel in both places, the intention of the Lord was the same. He did not want, you know, when he told Kaushalya that he should stay back and take care of Dashrata, he was thinking of the welfare of his father as well as the welfare of his mother. And when he's again coming here to Sita, as you said, you know, all the arguments, or predominantly most of the arguments, are, you know, you will not be comfortable there. It will be very difficult for you. So it, even this argument that you should stay back and you should take care of my parents is completely made with the welfare of the other person in mind. So I think this is a very beautiful indicator of what is dharma. Where there is a conflict of dharma, you know, where Swami would often say God first and yourself last and others come in between. You know, that is what it is, that if there is a conflict of dharma, if you're able to do it, you know, the decision which gives more priority to the other person's welfare
over your own,
over your own, I think that is where that will be more right than the other part.
That's a nice rule of the thumb. Another interesting thing that happens during this whole argument is several references to the future and past are made.
Right.
For example, if we take the future, Rama, while speaking about dangers in the forest, tells Sita, you know, Sita, there are some ablutions that Lakshmana and myself, as princes, as according to our birth, we have to do these. We have to do these prayers, not ablutions. I mean, after ablutions, prayers, and there are vows that we undertake. During this time, you will be alone in the wherever, you know, whether it's a cave or a hut, wherever we stay, you will be alone. At that time, what will you do? You know, who will protect you at such time? This actually, to the keen reader, you can make out that this is a hint of what is going to happen, that Sita will possibly be in danger when Rama and Lakshmana are not around. The other thing, other reference to the future, a hint that Rama gives is, what if, you know, there are many princes and kings who come to the forest to do hunt. You know, hunting is a favorite pastime for many of them. And when they come, if they cast their eyes on you, you are, you know, you're as beautiful as your character. You're so beautiful. You're an epitome of beauty. What if they cast their eyes on you? You know, what will you do then? So again, this is a hint of what is going to happen. That Ravana coming and casting his eyes on her and getting bewitched by her beauty. So for this, again, Sita responds with her complete conviction and faith that Rama, whatever it is, even if a wild animal eats me up when I'm in the forest, I would gladly die in your presence rather than die in your absence. And you know, if somebody can attack me in the forest with you by my side, then there's all the chance that anybody can attack me in Ayodhya also. And I would rather suffer in with you by my side rather than without you by my side. And she counters this Rama's hint towards the future with her own, you know, hint towards her past.
Right.
Where she, you know, narrates of an episode in her childhood, which indicates that what is happening is absolutely in sync with what is destined for her.
And she says of that incident when once her mother is sitting with Sita as a little girl, Sita sitting on her lap, and the mother is actually worried about her married life. You know, what kind of a bridegroom this little girl will get, because she is so virtuous. The husband she gets should be equally virtuous. You know, the mother is just thinking about such things when suddenly one of the maids come into her presence and say that there is an ascetic woman who's seeking audience with the queen. So immediately the mother puts the child down and she goes into the presence of this ascetic woman. So both the mother and child fall at the feet. And this ascetic woman looks at this little Sita and says that, you know, there will be a time when in the future, after her marriage, this little girl will spend a few years with her husband in the forest. And the queen is very surprised because, you know, why would somebody look at a small girl and talk about what would happen after her marriage?
Marriage, huh?
Right? And with such detail, with such a specific detail. And so Sita recalls that moment and she says, see, this is already there in my destiny. So if you're talking about destiny, you know, I have even that covered. You know, somebody's already given me a word that this is going to happen. So I'm so happy when you came and told me. I was so thrilled because the memory of this incident came to my, you know, came to me, and I felt that it is a fructification of that which is going to happen now.
And then she gives a pleading which no lord can resist from the devotee. She says, dear Rama, you know, I have in a sense been sad in the palace because you have so many attendants here, so many people to serve all your needs. I never get the opportunity to serve you. This is a golden opportunity for me, Rama. I don't look at it as a life in the forest. I look at it as a chance to be your maid, to be your wife, to be the person who fans you, to be the person who cooks for you, to be the person who feeds you. Everything, Rama. I mean, if we imagine ourselves doing that for Swami, why would we want to do any of our corporate lives or anything? We would love to give up everything to do these kind of direct physical seva for Swami, right? So she says, this is what I have dreamt of. And this is the kind of dream that Parvati had when she wanted to attain Lord Shiva. She did not care about the palace or anything. And so Sita says, Lord, I want to serve you. And this is a beautiful opportunity where I get to be your all in all. You know, from everything to everything I can get to take care, and this is a lifetime opportunity for me. Please, please don't deprive me of this.
And you know, this is another beautiful indication of why you would see in the history, in scriptures, you would always find that devotees embrace poverty or embrace a frugal living. Mm-hmm. Now you would always see that in all religions. If you see Islam, you have fakirs. If you see, in Christianity, you would see the priests taking the vow of poverty. You know, St. Francis of Assisi, you know, all of them. It is not that poverty is going to lead you to divinity. It is not that putting yourself through that process of strict self-abnegation is going to give you anything. But I think it's a means of telling yourself that I'm drawing true happiness only through the company of my Lord. Yeah. I think that is what Mother Sita is kind of explaining here. See, I have so many reasons to be happy here. You know, I have all the comforts of the palace. I have so many, you know, not one doting mother-in-law, but I have three doting mother-in-laws, and I'm being taken care of. But it is an opportunity for me to see that, am I really happy because I'm in your company?
Yes, it's an indicator for oneself.
For oneself. I think that is why all devotees, you know, go through that process of, you know, willingly taking upon themselves. Even if you see in the ashram, you would find people who would have lived in sprawling bungalows in the West. I've seen some of them who have huge houses in, say, in the United Kingdom or United States. They would come here and live in one-room apartment.
Not even a one-bedroom,
right?
One room.
Hmm. Eating very, very simple food, living very simple lives, because it is a means by which we can show to ourselves that, yes, I am happy being in the presence of the Lord. I can give up all these things and still be happy.
I remember one a master, I forget his name. He apparently, I think in Australia it was, when they had gone to Australia, every day he would go and sit in the, you know, bazaar, the market area, where a lot of activity, there's a commercial area. He would go there and he would just sit. And the disciples, you know, ever ready and eager to fulfill every desire and wish of their master, they would keep asking him, Master, do you want to purchase that? Do you want to purchase this? Do you want to purchase that? No, no, no. Finally, one day, after some 4 or 5 days of this, they said, Master, if you don't want to purchase anything, why do you want to go and sit in the market? Why do you want to sit there? He says, you know, it's a reminder for me every day that I'm happy without any of these. The minute I feel that I want something and I feel that my happiness depends on something, I know I have lost my happiness. As long as I look at all this and I can still be happy, knowing that my happiness is not dependent on it, that is when I'm happy. The minute I desire for anything, the minute I feel I want that, I feel that because I feel when I get that only I will be happy. Then I've lost my true happiness. This was the answer. So, as you said, this kind of vow of poverty, vow of celibacy is not because God demands it. God never demands us to be poor, nor us to be celibates or any of such thing, nor fasting, nothing. It is just as an indicator for our own self to know that I'm deriving joy now. It is not because of this. It is not because of this. It is purely because of the divine love in my heart.
And one more beautiful argument which Mother Sita gives, maybe this could be one of the final ones, where again, you know, as you said, it's an indication of what is to come, mm-hmm. about what would happen if somebody were to come and harm her and all that. And that's when Mother Sita says, have you forgotten who I am? I am the daughter of Prithvi. You know, I am the daughter of Mother Earth. And oftentimes, you know, in Indian scriptures, Prithvi is shown as the epitome of forbearance, of a person who is able to put up with enough amount of suffering. So she says, I have come inheriting that quality. I can put up with any amount of suffering. So don't give me this reason that it's going to be so much of pain. And the other thing is, have you forgotten that I lifted the Shivdanush which you broke? You know, so many emperors came and I think interestingly, it is always depicted that even Ravana has come and tried to lift that dish, Shivdhanush, and he failed. And she says that I lifted it, I pushed it even as a little child. Do you think I'm a weakling? So she says, I am as strong as you are. Don't forget that.
And finally, we have to, you know, go back to what Swami has said in his discourses, that Rama and Sita, they knew, you know, it was almost as if Rama said, Sita, now, you know, it's time for the divine plan. We have to, they knew this was part of the divine plan. Otherwise, how else can you explain that Ravana fails to lift the Shivadhanush? Sita is able to easily move it, not as an adult, huh? As a child when she was playing with the ball. And that mighty Sita is simply picked up and kidnapped by Ravana. So all this is part of a, you know, a kind of a master plan which becomes very, very clear about this. And Sita, as she says, you know, she is born of Mother Earth. That is why one of her names was Ayonija.
Mm-hmm.
Yoni stands for the womb. Ayoni means not of the womb. So not of the womb. She, Ayonija, Ja means born. So one who is born, not born of the womb, is Sita. And we know that she stands for Prakriti. That is what the Adhyatma Ramayana, one of the interpretations says. So Sita wins over Rama and Rama agrees. It has taken a long time and a long kind of debate between Sita and Rama agrees. So now Sita, Lakshmana and Rama, the trio, they head out. They head out to the emperor because they want to meet Dasharatha, the emperor. Not, remember, they are not going to meet Dasharatha, their father or father-in-law. They are meeting Dasharatha, the emperor, to offer their salutations to him and take his permission before leaving. And seeing his two sons in bark clothes and Sita walking along, it's almost as if Dasharatha knows what has transpired and what has happened. He laments and beats out his chest and he is crying. And seeing that sorrow, the whole assembly is sorrowful, and apparently it has been announced that this is what is happening because the whole assembly seems to be aware of what is happening. And Kaikeyi here, you know, it is tough, you know, to relate or not relate, actually narrate what is happening to Kaikeyi, because one is the Kaikeyi who is acting out, the other is the Kaikeyi who has been told to act by Rama. So, but Kaikeyi here, she says, she is apparently looking fearful because she is thinking that all this sorrow might lead to change in the decision. And you know, if we look deeper, she is afraid of the change in decision, not because her son will not become emperor, but because she will be disobeying what Rama had told her. She will be failing in what Rama wanted her to do. So she is very worried, and so she immediately brings out bark clothes and she hands it over to Sita and says that, you know, if you are also going, it's fine, but you know, here it is, take the bark clothes. And this is the time that Dasharatha can't bear. He gets off the throne and starts lashing out verbally to Kaikeyi, calling her the cruelest of ogres alive, ogress, Rakshasi. But apparently Kaikeyi is absolutely unaffected by all this. And that is a point in time when Vasishtha steps into the court.
I think before that, Swami gives a beautiful description of how Rama explains to Sita how to wear those clothes, because, you know, she is born a princess and she is, you know, married into this royal family.
Mm.
So very patiently, Swami, you know, beautifully says that Rama explains to Sita how to wear these clothes and, you know, how to dress modestly even in these clothes.
Bark clothes. Because right. Sita complains, she says, Rama, she doesn't actually complain, she says, Rama, you know, the saris that I'm used to are much longer than this, are much wider than this. Clothes made of bark, you can't process them, and also therefore they are not so big. And so she's wondering how to, and Rama takes her to a corner and he starts, you know, showing her how they should be worn. And there is immense sorrow in the entire assembly. This was the day they have all come to see a golden crown being placed on the head of their beloved Rama and Sita. And instead of that crown, they are being draped in bark. It's almost equivalent to what, you know, possibly the followers of Christ would have felt when they wanted to see their Jesus crowned as the king, emperor of Israel. Instead, he was being flogged and taken in the streets. That was a kind of contrast. You know, that contrast is what builds up so much of sorrow and a kind of depression, and that is what the entire assembly at Ayodhya was undergoing. And yes, it is at this time that Vasishtha comes, and apparently even the omnipresent powerful sage Vasishtha is also shocked at what is happening, and he thunders and says this has to stop, and he gives he dilates on how the political principles work. He says that, see, whatever may be the thing happening, whatever might be the word given or whatever might be the obligations or things that the king has committed to, it is a rule that always the eldest born is the ruler. So, okay. Rama is bound to be the ruler. But, of his own volition, if Rama chooses not to rule, that is okay. But then, if he is married, which he is, because he has Sita, when he gives up, as per law, as per the rule, as per dharma, as per the code of conduct, the entire responsibility goes over to Sita. If only Sita also refuses, then only you can find a next heir to take over the throne. And so now Rama has given it up, so he says, Sita, there is no need for you to wear bark clothes. In fact, there is no need for you to give up the kingdom. If Rama has given it up, it's okay. There is no need that Bharata take this up. You have to take it up. You know, he says, and this is again a time when Kaikeyi starts shivering. She starts shivering in, you know, in a fear whether this should not lead to a change in decision. But you know, Sita, anyone who would have witnessed or read through or heard through what has happened, transpired between Sita and Rama, will they ever believe that Sita will lay claim on the kingdom?
That's the beauty of this whole episode, you know. Oftentimes when you talk about the Ramayana, people who see it in a very, very shallow manner, they would say that, you know, the women doesn't have the right, you know, Sita had to just follow whatever Rama had to do. But actually, this entire episode shows that she actually had her way. You know, entirely when Sita was told to stay back, she said, no, I want to do this, I have chosen this. When the whole kingdom was offered to her, you know, it was not that the exile was thrust upon her. In fact, the kingdom was thrust upon her. You know, Vasishtha says that you have to rule. She says, no, I don't want to rule, I want to go with my lords. You know, that's the beauty of this whole thing, where at every point, the right of the woman is actually being portrayed, saying that, you know, even Sita says that I have the equal right. You cannot command me, I have the equal right. But it is not the right I am exercising. I am exercising my ability to pray to you, to plead to you. And that's the beauty. And when you look at this whole situation, with everybody, Dashrata, Vasishtha, as you said, even Vasishtha is so moved by pain, seeing this whole thing. I think the only two individuals who are happy is Rama and Sita. Because Rama is happy, in a sense, because he is able to follow his dharma, outwardly looking at it. Sita is happy because she is going to have the company of her lord. You know, she had it even in the palace, she is going to have it even in the forest. I think other than these two, everybody is upset and depressed.
And as a devotee, what I think we can take away from this is, as long as our focus is Rama, as long as our focus is our Sai Rama, our Swami, I'm sure that is what Hanuman sitting in the studio here and listening to the Ramayana being said will also agree to, that as long as our focus and sole goal is Rama, it doesn't matter what is happening, it doesn't matter who rules the kingdom, it doesn't matter what is the situation outside, we will be peaceful and happy. You know, I would like to add an extension over here. It's not just that we being peaceful and happy. Whosoever comes in contact with us will also get that peace and happiness. And that is what happened in Ashokavana. You know, one thing we'll see later on, that in the Lankan kingdom where Sita is kept trapped, while on one hand it is written of how Sita got scared by all the ogresses, there is definitely a fact that there were some of the ogresses who felt very calm because of Sita. So that kind of, you know, when God is our sole goal, automatically love and selflessness become our sole goal, and love and selflessness automatically have a calming, peaceful, and, you know, joy giving effect, cheer lending effect on everyone around. That is what happened right when Dharmaja went to the hell. All the souls in hell cried out and said, Dharmaja, don't leave hell. Because, you know, once you have entered hell, hell has become so soothing and cool. It was almost as if in order to maintain heaven and hell, Dharmaja had to be taken out of hell. Otherwise, hell is as good as heaven. So, that is a thing that shows that what makes us truly independent in terms of our happiness is to be fully dependent on the Lord. then our happiness will depend on nothing else, and that happiness will also spread from us, through us, to the entire world.
And since we've heard Ramayana over and over again, I think we've read it in many forms, some of the immensity of the situation actually misses us. You know, just imagine, even with our own comforts in our own home, if you are told, if you are, you know, one fine day thrown out of our house and told to live on the streets, it would just definitely be a rude shock. But here is somebody who is going to be an emperor. In fact, Swami would repeat this over and over again in his discourses. You know, see that contrast, because he's going to be an emperor. Dashrata was not an ordinary king. He did not have a small kingdom. Mm. You know, he was emperor of the whole realm. He has performed the Ashwamedha Yaga, and he's supposed to be an overlord of a huge subcontinent. And Rama from being that, Rama and Sita from being overlords, you know, they would worship. It was a time when kings were worshipped as God, but here of course is God himself. But from that state, they are going into the forest, and it is definitely, you know, you can think of going and camping in a forest now, you could still manage to carry enough.
I feel a modern day analogy would be, imagine you are promised the latest smartphone, and it is bound to happen, your payment has been made, it has to be, and it doesn't arrive. This is a situation worse than that. It doesn't arrive. At the same time, the phone that you are currently having is taken and smashed into smithereens. And now told, see, that is what it is. Rama was not told that you are not going to be king, continue to life as it is. You are not going to be king and you are going to get a downgrade now. So, you know, I was again imagining, with the phone itself is such a pain for us. Imagine what is the immensity and enormity when what you are going to get is, if we see Rama's kingdom, it's almost half the current land size of India today.
Right.
So it's an immense kingdom. And yet, as Rama walks out, you know, the first thing that he talks to the citizens is that you are all blessed people, for you are all living in the kingdom of Ayodhya. And he says, you know, please continue to be like good citizens like this. Obey the ruler, obey the emperor, because everybody who is ruling you are of the purest in their intent. They are the most wonderful people. I mean, Rama speaking so gloriously of apparently those who have caused all this downfall for him. Ah, it is really a lesson in humility, love, and most importantly, selflessness.
And I think, dear listeners, this is a good time to conclude this week's afternoon satsang.
Yes, we'll conclude with the statement that apart from telling this to the citizens, Rama also advises Sumantra, the minister who is very dear to Dasharatha. He says, my father will be in great pain, so please go and assuaj him. It is with this final message that Rama, Sita and Lakshmana, the trio, step out of the palace to head towards the forest. All the citizens have been told, and Sumantra has been given the message to convey to Dasharatha. And with this, the trio start towards the forest, towards the exile.
So dear listeners, we're going to conclude by playing that song which used to be part of Ramkatha. And in the later years, whenever the song used to be sung, Swami would emote with the feeling, because, you know, oftentimes Swami would say that he is beyond gunas. Hmm. But he empathizes, like, you know, when we become good people, one of the surest sign of goodness is empathy. So when Swami is the very embodiment of all goodness that you can think of, Swami would actually empathize. When Swami would cry, it was not the emotions what Rama or Sita had, because as we read it in Swami's own words, they were pictures of equanimity. But Swami would reflect the emotions of the people of Ayodhya when these three were driven out in a chariot to the boundaries of Ayodhya, even as they were stepping out into the forest. So I think we'll conclude with that song. And on the other side of the song, as always, we'll be joined by Brother Chandu. And next week, we'll join you with the continuing part of Ramkatha Swaini. On behalf of Arvind, on behalf of myself, we offer this humble effort of ours at Swami's Lotus Feet. Thank you. Jai Sai Ram.
വിനുടു രാമായണ ഗാഥ വിനുടേ മനസാര വിനുടു വിനുടു രാമായണ ഗാഥ വിനുടേ മനസാര ആലപിഞ്ചിന ആലകിഞ്ചിന ആനന്ദമൊലികിഞ്ചേ ഗാഥ വിനുടു വിനുടു രാമായണ ഗാഥ വിനുടേ മനസാര రామునిరా రాజు చేయగా కోరెను దశరథ భూజాని పౌరులెల్లవూ పొంగిపోయిరా మంగళ వార్త విని పౌరులెల్లవూ పొంగిపోయిరా మంగళ వార్త విని కారు చిచ్చుగా మారెను కైక మందర మాట విని మందర మాట విని వినుడు వినుడు రామాయణ గాథా వినుడీ మనసారా కనుక తెలిసియే తెంచెను భూపతి అడిగెను వరములు అతనివి సలుప వలయు పట్టాభిషేకము భరతునికి పృథివీ మెలగవలయు పదునాలుగేండులు రాముడు కారడవి చెడియ మాటకు అవును కాదని పలుకడు భూజాని కూలే భూమిపై వినుడు వినుడు రామాయణ గాథా వినుడి మనసారా రావించి మహీపతి ఆనతి తెలిపెనుపిన తల్లి మోసమిరిగి సౌమిత్రి కఠారి దూసెను రోజిల్లి భూషమని వెనుదీసె తమ్ముని రాముడు వేసారి వాస దీక్ష కోసలము కోరిపిన తల్లి పరాల వ్రాలి Thank you.